Let's look at some of the issues that we talk about on this program. Global warming, stem cell research, evolution versus intelligent design. If you pick just about any scientific issue with policy implications, and these days it seems that you can almost predict a person's position if you know how they voted in the last election. Democrat, I'll bet you support mandatory limits on greenhouse gas emissions, federal funding for stem cell research, the teaching of evolution but not intelligent design in science classes. Conservative Republican, I'd say voluntary limits on greenhouse gas emissions, no federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, teaching intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in biology classes, and skepticism about global warming. Now, I know I'm generalizing a bit, but it doesn't appear to you that science has become very, very politicized. And my next two guests think so also. One will make the case that the Republican Party is misusing or ignoring science in pursuit of its political agenda. He says the GOP has, quote, unleashed a perfect storm of science, politicalization, and abuse. My other guest says science is being mishandled, but the liberal left is to blame. And he says liberals have hijacked science for long enough. It's time to set the record straight, says they write on the cover of his new book. And his name is Tom Bethel, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Science. And he is also senior editor at the American Spectator in Washington. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Bethel.
Thank you.
Chris Mooney is the author of The Republican War on Science, published last year and out in this fall in paperback. He's the Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine. He's also in our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What is wrong with the way science is done these days, Tom?
Well, I don't quite agree that it's. I mean, Chris thinks that it's Republicans who have politicized science, and I'm not really saying in my book that the Democrats have. It's really a much more bipartisan
interest. It's a liberal. It says right on the cover, liberals have hijacked science for long enough.
You're quoting Dust Jacket Copy, which is maybe some truth to it, but my position is really more that it is politicized in a bipartisan way. And to illustrate what I mean, buildings on the NIH National Institutes for Health campus in Bethesda, Maryland, are named after congressmen or senators who control the funding for the NIH. For example, you have the Mark Hatfield Research Center, the Lewis Stokes Lab Building, Dale and Betty Bumpers Vaccine Center, John Porter Neuroscience Center, and so on.
So we got the Ronald Reagan Building in Washington also.
Well, yeah, but Ronald Reagan didn't, he was not responsible for the funding. I mean, these are congressmen and senators who are actually sending the money to the NIH. And in fact, when the ceremony for Lewis Stokes, where they kind of cut the ribbon, the acting director of the NIH said of Stokes, his word was his bond. We could take it to the bank, and we did so often. So
I'm trying to understand your point that you're trying to make.
The money, the people who are generous, as it were, in the funding of NIH programs, are in a position where they can get buildings named after them. Senator Coburn objected at one point, said this was a new low in Washington's culture of arrogance when federal agencies can be renamed in honor of the senators who control their budgets. The same was not true of Ronald Reagan. Of course, the National Airport is named after Ronald Reagan, but he didn't fund that. So what I'm saying is that government science has become much more, the problem is government has gotten control of science. It's not that the liberals or the conservatives, the Democrats or the Republicans have gotten control of it, is what I would say.
So who should be in control of science then?
Well, there is an ideal of science. I mean, there's what I think of as the constitution of science, which is a decentralized activity where experiments should be repeatable and propositions should be falsifiable and not based on authority or consensus as they tend to be now. A minority in real science, a minority of one can be right. But now with government science, there is a tendency to centralize power, to intimidate dissenters. The person who really foresaw this and put it better than anyone, I think, was Eisenhower in his famous military-industrial complex speech in 1961, just before the Kennedy inaugural. He, in the same speech, and very few people know about this, lamented about the increased share of research that was being taken over by the federal government, the decline of the solitary inventor, as he called him, and he feared the domination of scholars by federal employment, and he also commented that it looked as though government contracts were becoming a substitute for curiosity. These are amazingly prescient remarks made by Eisenhower, and in the same speech, of just a few sentences later as the military-industrial complex, government agencies have a tendency to want to expand and to enlarge their own mission, and in order to do this, they're inclined to discern crises and to inflate them, global warming, stems, and opportunities. And we've seen this in recent years in such as issues as global warming and bird flu, I think, is another one.
So you don't believe in global warming or that the bird flu is?
Well,
Is a potential problem.
Well, I mean, bird flu may be a potential problem, but we're talking about 120 cases over a 9-year period in the whole world, where there are 55 million people, I believe, die every year. And, you know, it is just, when you take the worst case scenario and you pump it up with headlines, the media, you know, of course, plays along because, in a sense, naturally, because for them, you know, a story saying that something frightening is going to happen is much more likely to, is much more headline worthy than if you have, for example, a climate scientist who says that climate is fine. A good example to illustrate the point is Richard Lindzen of MIT, who recently wrote an article in which he pointed out that the funding for climate change had increased by a factor of about 5 since the 1980s, and scientists who dissent from the alarmism are inclined to see their grants disappear, their work derided, and themselves libeled as the stooges of industry. Mm-hmm. So this is what is happening. It's as though the funding of government funding of science is used as a sort of mechanism of control. It tends to silence dissent, and the science itself is affected, I think. Scientists who work under these kind of regimes tend to settle in as doing 9-to-5 work, Monday to Friday job. Competition, which was the driving force of science, I think, is sort of eliminated when one government is funding the whole thing.
Let me get a reaction from Chris Mooney. Chris?
On which point? There were a lot of them there. Well, first of all, his book is largely an attack on the way the left is misusing science. I've read it, and I think that that's fair to say. On the issue of government funding, I mean, government funding is good for science in a lot of ways. We would not have gotten to the moon without government funding. So, you know, he's painting a very one-sided picture on that point. You sometimes need the government to fund research that industry doesn't want to take a big risk on, because in many cases it's basic research and they're not sure what they're going to get out of it, so that's why the government steps in. And there's a role for both, and ultimately we want a productive relationship between industry or private funding of research and government funding, and that's what we should hope for. We shouldn't just slam one side rather than the other. You know, just going point by point, let's talk about bird flu. Is it a problem? How big a problem is it? I don't know, but you know, I'd rather, you know, hear false alarms than be completely blindsided by a problem that comes out of nowhere. So, you know, it's not always completely bad to be Chicken Little in some sense. And we could go on and on and on, but I'll stop there.
I mean, this is how you get a $7 billion request. President Bush on the bird flu said, okay, let's have $7 billion extra for bird flu. And, you know, I mean, if you
take... But that's only 3 weeks of what we spend in Iraq.
Well, okay. Well, I would not be too enthusiastic about our engagement in Iraq either. I mean, incidentally, I think...
But I'm just putting in a perspective about how much money the government has.
Right. I understand. But on Chris's point there about how some government You know, the Manhattan Project, I guess, is the best example of a government project that did work. And I guess my answer to that is that I think that there has been a change. It's comparable to what has happened in education, is now happening in science. Education, government schooling also used to work at the time of the Manhattan Project and until quite recently. But the teachers and the teachers' unions have learnt to sort of game the system, and I think that we're seeing maybe a gaming of the whole system by government science now, where they, you know, it's the cushy life for science, and the pressure on them to come up with something is not that great.
Go ahead, Chris.
I guess we're beating up on government here rather than talking about the politics of science. But, you know, there's all sorts of drugs. Someone listed them all in my blog today in response to something that Tom Bethel had said, where, you know, without National Institutes of Health grants, these drugs would not have been able to get to market. One of them, of course, is Taxol, the great cancer drug. There's all sorts of wonderful things the government funding of science does. The real issue is not really about funding here. The real issue is about government agencies, i.e. in the Bush administration, that are pretty widely distorting, misrepresenting, and undermining scientific information and preventing their own scientist employees from speaking out on issues ranging from global warming to reproductive health to a number of others. This has become endemic within the Bush administration. That's the real problem, because this is happening within the corridors of power right now. And I think it's become almost a consensus point at this point in time that the Bush administration pretty much across the board misuses and undermines science.
Chris, Tom, do you agree that Dr. Hansen was incorrectly stifled by the White House?
Well, I'm not really sure that he was stifled. I mean, he seems like he went.
He said he was.
He went from one television station to another, saying that he was being stifled.
Do you think it would have been wrong to stifle him?
Yes, I do. Okay. I do. By the way, on the issue of, you know, government and private sector science, I mean that we're coming up to an interesting kind of possible case study right now with stem cell research. Stem cell research, as Chris Mooney goes on about in his book, he's very critical of President Bush, who actually funded stem cell research, but with restrictions. He never got the credit for actually beginning the funding in 2001. And then the opportunity was to do this embryonic stem cell research. And
the issue is not funding the research. The issue is misleading the American public by promising more than 60 available lines, which didn't exist. He misled all of us in a speech to the nation. He misinformed us, and I expect my politicians to tell me the truth. That's the issue.
That doesn't strike me as being a terribly significant issue. I mean, it may well
why be, is it not significant?
It may well be that some of those stem cell lines are not going to be functional.
We know that there are only 23. We know that he was wrong, and we also know that scientists immediately afterwards said, "What 60 lines? Where are these 60 lines?"
Okay, well, I'll go along with that. But
okay, well, that, you know, the president of a major speech shouldn't say something.
But the real objection has been that federal funding has not been available outside those stem cell lines, whether there were 60 or 23. Now, meanwhile, they were promising all of these cures with stem cell research of Parkinson's disease and diabetes and so on. And venture capital, of course, at that point could jump in. Private sector money could come in and do it. But they, in fact, find it much harder to do. The whole business of doing embryonic stem cell research in a way that will lead to these cures turned out to be extremely difficult. And they weren't. So at that point, California voted $3 billion. And so now they've got some government money there. But the interesting thing is that now, more recently, quite recently, Harvard has opened a stem cell research institute where they're using just private money. They're not using government money at all. Meanwhile, governments all over the world, about six different countries all over the world, Britain, Israel, Japan, South Korea, and so on, are all trying to do this using as much money, government money, as they want.
And the reason for that,
and let me
of
just
course,
I, let me just interrupt before we get to the rebuttal. Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Here with Tom Bethel, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Science, and Chris Mooney, author of The Republican War on Science. We're talking about the other governments have gone ahead and, contrary to the U.S. government, the federal government, gone ahead and funded stem cell research and taken many of the scientists with them from the United States, have they not?
Well, I think after California passed that initiative, I don't think that's true. Of course, we also had the fiasco of the actual fraud in South Korea.
But sorry, are you saying that we don't need the government to do these kinds of things because we can get other governments to do it and we can have private industry to do it?
I'm saying that we've got the point that I was coming to is that we have now got set up a kind of a competition, as it were, between the governments around the world that are funding it and various places, including right now Harvard, where they probably got some pretty good people working on this, as to see whether the private sector can do what the government research has been unable to.
It's not an opposition. It's not an either-or. We want the private sector to take basic research and turn it into cures, and we want the government to fund basic research because sometimes the private sector doesn't want to do that stuff because they don't know where it's going to lead. The two have to interact productively together. That's our great tradition in this country. You know, we have the government funding science since World War II, and then we have the private sector, the entrepreneurs, taking up some of the basic knowledge and then seeing what develops from that. I don't see what's wrong with that.
Let me move on. You say in your press release that the AIDS pandemic in Africa was invented. You're saying there is no AIDS pandemic in Africa?
What I'm the African AIDS story is complicated, but the point that very few people seem to know about is that AIDS was redefined. And at a conference that was held in Bangui in 1985, 20 years ago, in which you no longer needed the human immunodeficiency virus to be present for the disease, the condition to be diagnosed as AIDS. The person could have 10% weight loss, I think it was, persistent diarrhea, various other things that were all, if they were all added up, they gave points, then you could diagnose that person as suffering from AIDS. And the result was at that point that, you know, millions of people all over Africa became eligible for an AIDS definition. The second problem is that there is no really reliable, although they did also do AIDS HIV testing in sub-Saharan Africa, but the problem with the AIDS test is there are lots of other conditions, and the health conditions in sub-Saharan Africa that are present all over the place are enough to trigger a false positive on the test, because it does not uniquely read positive if there's an HIV.
All right, we'll get to it more. I have to rudely interrupt and take a break, talking with Chris Mooney, the Republican War on Science, Tom Bethel, the Politically Incorrect Guide to Science. Your questions when we get back. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this message. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science and politics with my guest, Tom Bethel, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Science, out last year from Regency Publishing. He's senior editor. Excuse me?
Regnery,
thank you. Senior editor at the American Spectator in Washington. Chris Mooney, author of The Republican War on Science, out last year from Basic Books. He's also a Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Tom, you were telling us that, there are 40 million cases of AIDS in Africa now?
Well,
they're not AIDS cases. Is that what you're saying?
Well, these are estimates. There aren't 40 million. I think it's more like 25 million is what they're estimating. But when the WHO did an actual count, where they actually counted actual AIDS cases, there were only about 700,000. Mm-hmm. And the population decline that was forecast in the year 2000, when Clinton took the whole issue of AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa to the United Nations Security Council, the population decline has never happened. And in fact, the population of sub-Saharan Africa has increased in the last 20 years by 299 million people the last time I looked, which is equal to the total population of the United States. And there was a Washington Post story.
You know what, he's raising vague doubts and ignoring the expertise of the entire World Health Establishment on this question, and it's just really shocking to me that someone could say this about this crisis that we have going on in Africa. But this is the way Bethel approaches scientific topics repeatedly: global warming, deny the whole thing and ignore all of the relevant experts. Evolution, deny the whole thing, ignore all the relevant experts. And before, he was questioning the extent of AIDS in Africa. He was actually questioning whether HIV causes AIDS, and he even wrote an article at one point citing, quote, dissident physicists in order to call into question Einstein's theory of relativity. So I think there's a pattern here.
See, what you're saying here is that the experts that there is a kind of consensus that should be allowed to develop and nobody should be allowed to say anything against that. That's basically your
argument. No, I'm saying that a lot of people have studied this problem, spent a lot of time on it, and when consensus develops in science, it's based on repeated testing of an idea, and when it does develop, that's a very, very strong thing.
Do you think, Tom, that an individual scientist, the opinions of one is just as valuable as a consensus of the general scientific community? And should hold as much weight no matter what the information is?
I wouldn't say that, but there has been a lot of controversy about AIDS, especially in Africa, especially when you redefine it so that you don't have to have the HIV test at all.
That's because they have trouble with the facilities. They can't always perform the test, so they do the best that they can with what they have available. And, of course, they can't always do the clinical examination that you would want. So what are we going to do? We're going to make do, and we're going to have to do some estimating, okay? There's a lot of people. There's limited resources. I mean, be reasonable about this.
Estimates were grossly exaggerated.
And okay, we made that point. Let me move on because there's so many other points to get to. We don't have as much time. You also talk about in your book intelligent design. And yes. Saying intelligent design has more evidence in its favor than Darwinism.
Now, I'm afraid what you're doing here, Ira, you're to some extent quoting from the press release that was put out. I do not actually say that in the book.
Let me get the page.
Are you at war with your publisher here? I mean, you know, he's quoting your cover, he's quoting your press release. You don't support these things?
Well, I do believe that there is. I do believe that it looks as though the intelligent design is involved in the organisms that exist. And I think that the evidence for evolution is extremely weak.
Well, so you flip-flop on this then, because I'd like to read you a quote from your book, page 202. You say, if the advocates of design can invoke an invisible designer or God who can prevail over all difficulties anytime he wants and design any form of life at will, then we are more within the realm of magic than science. That's from your book. Well, so you didn't seem to be supporting intelligent design there.
Well, I guess I feel about the same way as David Belinsky, who feels, you know, have you read any of his articles, who's interested in intelligent design? I mean, it looks as though the Darwinian mechanisms are inadequate and insufficient to create the organisms that we see. Now, you raise...
Well, according to who besides you? I mean, the entire scientific consensus on this, the National Academy of Sciences, everyone...
Oh, consensus.
Right. The consensus on evolution, which goes back many, you know, Tom Bethel wrote an article in 1976 where he actually said that evolution was on the verge of collapse, and of course that didn't happen. It's only gotten stronger since then, and the best evidence that we have, the strength of evolution is convergent evidence from a wide variety of different fields.
Tom, what about that judge in Pennsylvania? He's sort of really...
Oh, sure.
A very scholarly treatise on that, did he not?
He has no
dog in this race, you know?
No, I would say that intelligent design, I'm completely opposed to the idea of trying to bring it into the classrooms or trying to make it compulsory in any way. It has to be, it's a battle that has to be fought, you know, in the free market. Now, Mooney makes a point in his book that I thought was interesting, where he says that, you know, he quotes the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, saying that intelligent design is pseudoscience. And the reason he gives is because they subscribe to a philosophy of science called methodological naturalism, which is a mouthful for saying that only physical causes are going to be allowed in science. Only material causes can be allowed. It is a form of materialism.
Right. When we hear thunder, we no longer think the gods are angry. That's basically what we're talking about here.
So
we use explanations
that
are natural.
You pose the alternative to this, the supernatural or the miraculous. Now, there is something else. You can thread that needle. There's something else. And to illustrate the point, there is a concept of agency. I'm going to lift my arm. The listeners can't see it right now. I've got my arm stuck out, and I'm going to lift it. My arm goes up. What caused it to go up? Muscles, you could say, well, muscles caused it to go up. But it was my mind that made the decision. So mind introduces the concept of agency. And where does, you know, there is this constant intervention in the natural world in ways that do not have to be regarded as being miraculous.
Okay, you're equating your mind and the mind of God. And the difference is that I can see you in the room here.
But what happens if you can't see what... the actual mechanism of what's operating, you know, in my brain, or, you know, they've looked and looked, and the fact of the matter is it looks as though mind is in some way not a materialistic thing, and there is this intervention takes place constantly.
All right, let me just move on to another topic. Let's talk a little bit about global warming. There's that Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth, showcasing the vice president's effort to avert a major catastrophe. There's also a federal study out last month that concluded that the Earth's lower atmosphere is warming, and humans are influencing global climate. Do you think that the two sides are finally coming together, Tom, or do you still think that the jury, as the president says, the verdict is still out on this?
I think the verdict is we're not going to reach a verdict yet. I mean, I think the problem is that the time is too short. I agree that in recent decades the globe has been warming, but to say that it is caused by humans, I do not accept that.
What would it take for you to agree to that?
I think it would have to go on for much longer. It's only been going on for less than 30 years, and there was a period of about 30 years before that in the mid-20th century when there was global cooling, when there was still plenty of carbon dioxide being emitted into the atmosphere. I read recently that the Mars Global Surveyor showed that ice caps are shrinking over the last 9 years in Mars. I don't know what the cause of that might be. Two Russian physicists bet $10,000 that there will be cooling, perhaps within about 10 years, and solar radiation may well be the cause. We don't know. But the thing is, it would be extremely costly and expensive for the U.S. to do this.
Can I address this global cooling?
We would bear all of the costs, and, you know, very little benefit would be achieved.
Chris?
Well, yeah, I mean, this global cooling thing, you know, you hear it all the time. There's this blogger who's proposed this game called Global Warming Skeptic Bingo, where if they make an argument that's been discredited over and over again, you put one bingo thing there and another one there. Global cooling is one of them. We know why. It wasn't global. It was mostly in the Northern Hemisphere, and scientists know very well why it happened. It was actually human-caused. It was air pollution, sulfate aerosols, which basically counter the effect of carbon dioxide. And now, of course, we have the Clean Air Act amendments, which took the sulfates out of the air, and so then the carbon dioxide came back. That's the accepted scientific position. I don't know why. I've told Tom Bethel this on the air before, that the sulfate aerosol explanation, but he keeps citing this cooling period in order to undermine the role of carbon dioxide. I just don't get it.
What about the earlier periods of the medieval warm period? The attempt to claim that the present warming is unprecedented, it seems to me they had to do a lot of jiggery-pokery with statistics to get rid of what was obviously an earlier warmer period.
Did you see Al Gore's film?
I have not seen the movie, no. I'm told that it's very well made, but I haven't seen it. Now, maybe Al Gore will get to be president in 2 years, and then at that point he can submit the Kyoto Treaty for ratification. And I'm just sorry, in view of the fact that he thinks it's so serious, that he didn't do this before when he and Clinton had a chance between 1997 and 2000.
Well, if you watch the movie, you'll see he has tried to do this before in Congress when he was a senator and congressperson. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Paula in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Paula.
Hi, yes.
Quickly.
You guys are ping-ponging over so many subjects, it's hard to follow.
Makes your head spin, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. You guys are talking pretty fast. But I want to make sort of focus on a particular thing. I just have a couple points to make about it, which haven't been addressed. And I don't think consensus confers rightness necessarily, just on that point. But what I'd like to know is, what did the two guests think of the role of pharmaceutical companies in determining the scientific agenda? Because I am hearing all about cure. You're talking cure, 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 and I'm not hearing anything about looking into why are we getting these diseases, i.e., you know, environmental degradation, and there's no money to be had in that, of course. And I'd just like to know what your guests think about, for example, the mercury issue in vaccines and all the kinds of things that are going into making chronic illness sort of the norm here. And why is the policy being driven toward cure and not toward prevention?
All in the next 5 minutes, you want to hear all of that? We'll pick one out, Paula, see what we can do. Thanks for calling. Chris, you want to pick one of those, or Tom, one of those you'd like
to address? I'll just say briefly, consensus doesn't automatically confer rightness, but when consensus has developed over a long period of time through institutionalized skepticism of the scientific process, and many people have arrived at the same conclusions, that's a very powerful thing. That's all I'm really trying to say. You know, I'm afraid I don't know a lot about the mercury and vaccines issue, so I'm going to pass on that.
I don't really either, although it does bring up, it brings us to another outrageous issue which I have in my book, which is the idea of hormesis, the idea that, in fact, in low doses, a lot of chemicals, almost all chemicals that have ever been tested, turn out to be actually, if the dose is low enough, they are actually beneficial. And this is one of these, the mercury scare, I think, is maybe another thing that's been overplayed.
1-800-999-8255 is a number. We're talking with Chris Mooney and Tom Bethel this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Tom is author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Science. Chris, The Republican War on Science. What about the future? Do you think that, Chris, that this mood in Washington is here to stay for a while?
I don't see it changing in the near future. I think what we have is the institutionalization of science abuse, essentially. And I think it's not that Democrats are 100% innocent or the political left is 100% innocent. There certainly have been some problems, and I talk about some of those in my book. We could get into those. But I think with the political right today, what you have is you have two key interest groups, industry on the one hand, religious conservatives on the other. And there's a lot of scientific information between them. They want to attack things like global warming for the industry side, evolution for the religious conservative side. And they've built up think tanks that go around putting out all of these sorts of arguments, and then Republican politicians pick them up in turn and make them, and in some cases they influence policy. That's the structure of the way the misuse of science is working right now, and because this has been built up so well, I don't see it going away anytime soon.
I would just say Chris has a chapter called Sexed Up Science, and it deals with the religious right and the supposed influence of the religious right. And in a way, I kind of agree to some extent with what he says. He talks about arguments that are made in the guise of science against condom efficiency in favor of abstinence education, against the Plan B morning after pill, the health consequences of abortion, and so on. And I was thinking about this as a $170 million program of abstinence education. And if you think about that, who has really failed here? I mean, the fact that the fact that figures on the religious right are using arguments, scientific arguments, which may indeed not always be very good, against these things, tells me that the religious right has not been strong at all. They have been totally unable to stem the sexual revolution as a result of which all these things are happening. I mean, it's the failure of the religious leaders, the failure of the bishops to address any of these issues. So some of these figures on the religious right are now trying to come in with scientific arguments. So contrary to what you say, it does not show the strength of the religious right at all.
Well, the religious right is a reaction in many ways to the sexual revolution. So, of course, they failed to stem it. That's why they are now so active. And so now they have a lot of power with this administration. So now it's very troubling.
Why, of course, were they unable to stem it? Why would that be a matter of course?
I think that a lot of the mobilization of Christian conservatives, if you look historically, and their integration into the Republican Party and their activization as a political force happens, you know, in reaction to the 60s. That's what I'm trying to say.
You say at one point the deeper issue is the administration has been able to rely on the expertise of Christian conservative scientists. It's as though you really wish they weren't there at all, really. They've been able to rely on them. I mean, would it be better if they just didn't exist?
No, we need a good process in order to assess information on all of these topics, whether it's reproductive health or something else. And what we should never be doing is picking this one outlier guy who's making an argument that's well outside the mainstream and saying, oh, we're going to go with him. That's a political decision, rather than having a good scientific assessment process and figuring out what the end result is there. And that's right, what that's they're
the,
doing.
That's the last word we're going to have. I'm sorry, we've run out of time. I want to thank Tom Bethel, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Science, senior editor at The American Spectator in Washington, Chris Mooney, author of The Republican War on Science, and Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Marty Curcius in Washington and Manya in New York. Kim Jones is our technical director. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today, as always, and we usually always need it, from librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Finn. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have our blog and our podcast, back editions of Science Friday. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection there, where you can use Science Friday material to help teach science in your science classes. Have a great and safe weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.